What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield. Autism spectrum disorders are complex disorders with a range of conditions. They can have very different features and symptoms and often are difficult to understand for families and professionals. This hour, 411 Teen talks with Dr. Janet Linfala. She is the author of The Unprescription for Autism, A Natural Approach for a Calmer, Happier, and More Focused Child, and the founder of Autism Health. Janet is also the mother of three boys with a variety of issues, such as Asperger's syndrome, Tourette disorder, OCD, anxiety, and ADHD. Janet, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes. What is autism spectrum disorder? What are we talking about?
It keeps changing, Dr. Liz. It's a collection now, they say, of little autisms. But basically, you're going to find difficulty with social skills and relationships, verbal and nonverbal communication. It's not the old stereotype that we have in our mind of a silent person who's completely lost their language, rocking and flapping in the corner. That myth is gone. And it's getting much more refined these days.
Well, is it an epidemic? And I say that because now it seems like every time you turn around, there's someone or a celebrity, you know, talking about their child who is in the spectrum. Or are we just more sophisticated in identifying it?
Well, I think we are more sophisticated in identifying it. But I also, I'm reading a lot of research and scientific studies that seem to indicate the environment can be triggering the way our genes are expressed, that it seems like there's more of it. As we look back, we're realizing autism has probably always been with us. But I do think there is better diagnosis, and I do think there's more of it. I hesitate to use the word epidemic because it's sort of an alarming word. But at the same time, if more than 2% of the boys were being born with two heads, we'd call that an epidemic.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
We're trying to, you know, the language is changing, and we're trying to not use the hurtful, alarming words that have been used in the past. So I hesitate to use epidemic, but I will agree with you, there's a lot of it these days.
When, share your experience with us. I mean, when did you first suspect something had gone awry with your son?
Well, as a new mother, I felt the very first night something had gone wrong because he never slept like I expected him to sleep. Of course, I was not thinking autism at the time. It took us, in fact, 6 or 7 years to actually realize it was autism. My son's 21 now, so he was mid-90s, and the understanding wasn't there. I think we all still had the old stereotypes in our mind and everything, but he would sleep as a new infant about 20 to 30 minutes out of every 90 minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, really?
And it just on and on and on, and it was exhausting because neither one of us was getting a full sleep cycle, and yet he seemed so hyper, and I could tell he had a lot of gastrointestinal issues, and I didn't know what was wrong, but he was not like the other babies that other people were having.
Okay. Well, often they talk about major features that are characterized with the autism spectrum disorder. I mean, I think you touched on them, impaired social interaction or problems in verbal or nonverbal communication. Did you see this? Was his behavior repetitive? You know, you talk about the first 6 years. Did he seem to be have any unusual interest or activities?
He did not meet any of the screening criteria that we use these days. The only single thing that he did not meet was that when he was probably 8 or 9 months old, he wasn't waving hello or bye-bye. nothing else would have caught him in the current screening. And he came out talking. That's our joke. He had Asperger's syndrome. So, you know, they don't lose their language with that form of autism.
Mm-hmm.
There's no delay. And he was very advanced physically and very advanced in communication. In fact, he was very drawn to foreign language even as a toddler and wanted everything, all the computer games in five languages. He wanted books in multiple languages and everything was language, language, language. So, to be honest, autism was the very last thing that we were thinking.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it. I mean, he was definitely not the typical or stereotypical that you think of when you say autism spectrum disorder.
Right, and all those stereotypes have since been blown away and broken, too, because they're all unique and all different. And, you know, I see children and adults here at my office all the time, and none of them are alike.
Mm-hmm. What did diagnosis rely on? What did it involve at the time that he was diagnosed? And if at all possible, can you compare and contrast it to how one is diagnosed today?
Back then, this was probably in 2002, and we went to one of the top places in our state for diagnosis. And it's how I tell people not to do it nowadays. Basically, several doctors sat in a room and interacted with him and observed him for about 20 minutes, and then they turned to me and went, yep, he's on the autism spectrum. I think back then they used spectrum. And we were momentarily silenced, and my husband and I just kind of took a deep breath and said, okay, what do we do now? Is there anything we can do for him? And the doctors all burst out laughing and said, no, there's nothing you can do. Just stick him in the school system and let them take care of him. And I have never forgotten how that visit was handled. I just think it was wrong. And yes, you know, you can sometimes observe and interact with someone and say, yes, I feel he does have autism spectrum disorder, but I feel that's doing a disservice to the child or adult, and here's why. Autism is a package deal. It comes with usually, not always, but usually sensory issues that can be overwhelming, anxiety. They're more prone to physical things like colds and allergies and asthma. There's a subset of them that have gastrointestinal dysfunction. They're more prone to mood disorders. I like to see people get what I call a comprehensive psychological evaluation that looks for all these things. It'll look for attention problems or learning disorders. Why just sit in a room and go, yep, he has this one thing, and do the person a disservice? We're looking, you know, we're not looking to cure or prevent or treat autism. It's not the tragedy people used to think it was. But what we want to do is if there's a skill deficit or a language deficit or a health problem that we need to deal with, we want to know so that we can go after it. So I think a comprehensive, you know, bank of testing and evaluation needs to happen these days. And we're seeing a little more of that. But I still have patients roll in every week that said, yeah, the doctor just kind of shrugged and said she's on the spectrum and didn't do any testing. And I'm still baffled by that.
Yes, I guess so. Now, these doctors that you're referring to, are they just physicians who are doing it? Because I'm just wondering, maybe they just don't have the training that's necessary. You know, in medical school, I don't know what kind of training they would get for identifying autism. I'm just wondering what's going on. That has changed now, though, hopefully.
It is changing.
Okay.
People are far more aware of it. Pediatricians are screening for it. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics is really on top of things for screening, and they're recommending that all children be screened for developmental delays, and then if that, you know, lights up a little bit on the screening, then they screen them for autism. These testing methods, if that's what you want to call them, have come from a variety of healthcare professionals, from nurses and MDs and DOs to psychiatrists to neurologists. We have in our state, I think it's in most of the states, is birth to three services. And those people seem to really be on top of it. They're very thorough and very nice about approaching the parents with the suggestion their child might be on the spectrum. And no one should burst into laughter and laugh at you and say, there's nothing you can do. Uh-huh. There's one place in our state that routinely gives people a diagnosis and then says, your child will never go to college, your child will never drive, your child will never, just gives them a laundry list of things their child will never do. And I can tell you as a parent, that would be heartbreaking. And I just don't think you can predict that child's future like that, and it shouldn't be done that way.
Of course, it does. The efficiency does vary according to the state, and you are in West Virginia, and there may be some states that are more sophisticated.
There might be, but we do see patients here from 12 states,
mm-hmm.
from far away as Alabama and Illinois, and we hear
the
varying stories, mm-hmm. either good or bad, from all the different states.
What suggestions do you offer to parents who may be experiencing some question about their child's status, the problems they may be experiencing?
Again, I would direct parents first to a comprehensive psychological evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm not that big on labels unless a label is needed to obtain services. You know, that's all
right. Now, that's where it's helpful, yes.
Sure. So, you know, the autistic brain is this wonderful thing. Autistic people are some of the coolest, smartest people I know. They don't give off the same social signals as typically developing people. But I would tell parents to take a deep breath and relax. This is not, a tragedy or a catastrophe.
Right.
And just think about what your child needs. If there's a need to work with an occupational or physical therapist, you know, go get an evaluation and get some therapy. If there is a need for speech services, I would like to see people get behavior under control early on. And the last 20 years have been eye-opening on what is driving some of the irritability and behaviors in children and adults with autism. It's not part of autism. It's not a core deficit of autism. There's this whole host, this whole range, infinitely variable for each person, of health challenges.
Okay.
Like I said, the gastrointestinal component alone, if a child is struggling daily with acid reflux and constipation, inflammation, diarrhea, that, you know, that's, to do so on a daily basis is terrible just for a few days, but to do so on a chronic basis, you just don't feel well.
We've got to take a brief break, but I'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen is talking with Dr. Janet Linfala. She's in West Virginia. Janet, you want to continue? I had to interrupt you.
Oh, sure. And I do want to continue because this is an important point.
Right. I think so.
Many people, including parents, including my husband and I when our son was younger, do not realize these physical challenges. So we go to a doctor's appointment, and we say, my child has autism, but he can't sleep. And we are immediately offered a sleeping prescription.
Mm-hmm.
We might say he's constipated all the time, and we're told to put a child on laxatives forever, which we would never do for anyone else. We might say, oh, he's irritable, he's destructive, he's a sweet kid, but when he gets mad, he really tears up the house. And they'll put the child on an antipsychotic. And I do want to point out, I did not write the anti-prescription. Our house uses prescription medications when they're appropriate and necessary, and I'm not against them. But no one is asking why the child can't sleep or can't behave.
Right.
And I have this little analogy I like to use. If we were on a horseback ride and going on a trail ride, and one of the horses was very irritable and behaving difficultly, no one would say, hey, isn't there a horse antipsychotic that's approved for irritability in horses? No, we would stop the ride and say, are we too close to the road? Is the bit bothering him?
Mm-hmm. You know, we would, exactly.
Yes, we would search out the source of discomfort, but a lot of times I'm not seeing that happen for these young kids. And it's well-meaning doctors. I'm not knocking doctors. They're thinking, hey, got some drugs approved for irritability and autism. Here, let me help you out. Here's a prescription. So I just would like to point out,
I think that's important.
Go to a pediatrician, a developmental pediatrician who understands these health issues, and you can find one at MedMaps.org. That's the Medical Academy of Pediatric Special Needs. They're doing the cutting-edge training of physicians for autism in the country.
Okay. Do you feel like all babies should be screened for autism?
Absolutely. There's no reason not to screen. It's not invasive. It's not even costly. And why let a child go several years without working on social skills or poor muscle tone or language skills? I mean, why waste those years? We all know earlier intervention is better. And I think all children in the general population ought to be screened for autism.
Well, let's look at etiology. I mean, what do you feel is the etiology? I mean, you know, it could be genetics. Some have said genetics. Some have identified vaccinations, although I think that that has been dispelled, so to speak. We do know the individual that came up with the vaccinations. There was some real question about the credibility there. Environmental exposures, what do you ascribe to?
It's actually sort of a mix of genetic and environmental triggers, plus the timing of the environmental trigger on that particular child's development. So, for example, we don't see 50-year-old people suddenly becoming autistic because they had some kind of environmental exposure. So typically it's going to be lots and lots of triggers, different ones based on each child's genetic package. There is no single autism gene. They think there's thousands of genes actually involved. And what it is the environment can change the way a gene functions. So have you heard of epigenetics?
Yes, certainly have.
So it doesn't actually cause a mutation in the genetic material, but it might turn a gene on or off, or the way a cell might read the gene. And so the function changes, and that, I think, is creating a lot of these health issues for the children and adults. And so, yes, the environment's involved, but it's not completely environment. And, yes, genetics are involved, but it's not completely genetics. And with that many genes involved, and who knows how many environmental triggers at different times, that's why they're all different, and you can't pick one trigger and one gene.
So it's kind of eclectic, basically, what you were saying there.
Good word,
yes. And in that same notion, I guess that would explain or at least address why we may not see parents with autistic kids being autistic themselves or in the autistic spectrum disorder.
I don't know that they are presenting the same as today's children, because depending on their age, there might have been fewer environmental triggers back then. But we are seeing parents of autistic children be autistic themselves, and sometimes you'll see lots of nice blogs and magazine pieces out there now. They are going through the process of discovering their child is autistic, and they get a big aha moment when they realize they are also on the spectrum. And we can see it here in our office, and you know, we don't feel the need to point it out if they're perfectly functioning parents. I mean, like I say, I'm not big into labels, but definitely there are lots of visits here where after the family leaves, we have had the feeling that the parents or another family member were also on the spectrum.
Well, you know, I've seen those who are in opposition say with this new, with the whole spectrum, almost anybody can be considered on the spectrum because it's so broad and it includes so many characteristics and behaviors. Would you address that or talk to that?
I am seeing that same backlash, and there's some eye-rolling, and people are going, well, just everybody's on the spectrum. And I think we broadened the definition. We learned how to screen better, so some people that were formerly placed in other categories are being pulled into the spectrum category. But no, I don't think everyone is a little autistic. I think you can compare yourself with that diagnostic criteria, and either you meet it or you don't. It's just that we're more aware. And you know what? We aren't even catching everybody. We're not really capturing the females mm-hmm. or the minorities. Well, and we're learning girls present differently from boys. We've been missing the girls.
Well, males, we do know, are four times more likely to meet the characteristics of the spectrum than we're saying females. Can you shed any insights concerning this characteristic in looking at males?
Yes. Now, we're screening based on tools that were developed by studying males.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we're going to catch more males with the screening. But we're realizing the girls present completely differently. For example, a girl on the autism spectrum, if she were a boy, she probably wouldn't even qualify because of that screening tool. She is going to present more like a typically developing boy of the same age who's not on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
We always say, well, boys are a little less mature than girls. They're always a little behind. Well, that's how the autistic girls are presenting, just like those neurotypical or typically developing boys. And so that screening tool based on boys isn't catching them. And the girls, you know, are quite different. They tend to be more social.
Mm-hmm.
And they can mask it. They can fake it better. And they've had to fake it better because they're not getting, you know, any support services because they haven't been identified. They tend to have more imagination. They don't have as many repetitive behaviors, the flapping or the rocking. So that's a visible uh-huh. way to identify people, and we're not seeing that. They have more pretend play. Their areas of hyperfocus are different from boys, and they almost blend in and match typically developing girls' interests. So they're just kind of invisible. We haven't screened properly, so now the call is, we need to develop gender-based screening tools that will identify them. And, you know, we're not catching a lot of children of color. And I'm wondering if there are cultural differences that are accounting for us missing them. And I just don't think we've identified everybody yet.
Right. And often, I think we need to at least say this, often the children of color who may present with behavioral problems are either sent to the intellectually compromised classes, and they don't bother to do the screening at all. They're just, you know, they have some intellectual problems, and that's it. And so they don't go even, you know, it's like they don't warrant the screening at all.
Well, I'm not sure what's going on with the screening. I don't know mm-hmm. if the families, like, culturally are responding to that. Mm-hmm. I see children of all color, if they are a behavior problem, they go right into the severe behavior
right.
class, no matter what their level of schooling. And I'm sure, you know, there's probably some numbers out there, Dr. Liz, that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be more aware of this than I am. So I'm not discounting what you said. But I'm just saying people, all they see is the behavior.
Right,
they go,
exactly.
Let's put them in a different classroom and let's medicate them until they shut up.
Exactly. And I think when you look in those special classes, I was just going to add this, when you do look at the composition of those special classes, you find that they often have more children of color, okay? And that's a whole nother issue as to why they're children of color, you know, and we could go on and on. But you do find that that often is the case, okay?
And if that is true, that is so not right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No. Just, I think that is wrong to just assume that it's more of a behavioral issue and they're more prone to behaviors because of their color or their culture. And we need to develop completely different screening tools that are, and I think we're
exactly.
and moving
you
in that
hit
direction,
it.
But it's like, you know, by committee, everything moves very slowly over the
yeah,
years.
Exactly.
You know, we're changing. We're
exactly. changing. You're the founder of Autism Health. What is Autism Health?
Autism Health is just my office where I see patients, mm-hmm. children and adults, and I donate my time here, and I didn't really intend to open an office. You know, I graduated at 8 months pregnant with my first son, who turned out to be the one on the spectrum, and was unable to practice for 14 years. But I have this BS in genetics. I have a strong science background and health and medical background. And I started going to conferences as a parent, and other families would go, what'd you learn? Tell us. Share with us. And I realized I had a knack for understanding the science and then translating it into terms lay people could understand. So people began calling me, and I began finally doing workshops in my kitchen, and we outgrew that. Mm-hmm. I outgrew a local store, and finally I told my husband, I said, I just want to have an office where all the phone calls can go, and I can keep all the books and papers. And within 6 months, I had to hire a full-time office manager. I still donate my time here. I've never charged for my time, which I'm happy to do, but we're just so shocked. We get people coming from 12 states. There's a hunger. There's a need to know about these health issues and these simple, natural ways to balance those and support those and calm everybody down without medicating them out of their mind. And then when all that, you know, sorts out of the picture, now we can see if medication's appropriate. Perhaps someone does have a mood disorder or some anxiety that can't be controlled, and that's when medication's appropriate. So autism health is just hopefully a place where they can come for education and knowledge and support of health issues and a shoulder to cry on sometimes, or, you know, just I live this life, so right. We know what they're going through, and we just try to be there for them.
How does one contact you?
Well, our website, www.loveautismhealth.com, is a great place to start. Okay. We have a very active Facebook page, Autism Health, and we try to respond throughout the day to questions in between patients and things. So our phone number is 304-255-2550.
Okay. Let's talk about the parents and the impact of this condition, this disorder, on your family and family life. Would you talk to the parents?
Well, it's very different now. My boys are older. Mm-hmm. I have two in college, and we have a very peaceful home now. But back in the day, it was not peaceful. My son was very sunny-natured when he was born, but by the time he was 3 and 4 years old, we began to realize he was very irritable. And by the time he was 5 or 6, he was just angry. He woke up angry many days. He was impulsive. Nothing ever stopped him from doing anything. We would find him up on the roof just exploring to see what was up there. And if we put him in his room for a timeout on the second floor, a minute later, he'd have jumped off the porch roof and rung the front doorbell. I mean, just we never knew. We couldn't take our eyes off of him. And he was such a fun child and so hungry for knowledge, but his behavior was out of control. He never hurt people or animals, mm-hmm. never, but he was very destructive around the house, and his rages just wouldn't stop. And we began to realize it was isolating our family, and he wasn't getting invited to birthday parties. And, you know, when the kids are young, they say, bring the whole family. So our other boys also, we began to realize, got invited to very few things because, you know, the one son's behavior was so unpredictable. Sometimes we had to take two cars to go out to dinner or on vacation because at the drop of a hat, we might have to take the oldest one home if he was having a meltdown. And I felt like my husband and I had parallel play, you know, always in separate cars. And at one point, we considered buying the home next door to us because my son couldn't tolerate the sensory hustle and bustle of a busy family with three boys. Very difficult until we began to understand the health issues and to realize it wasn't autism that was the problem. It was the sensory, the anxiety, the hyperactivity, things like that. And now he's a junior in college. He drives. He's an Eagle Scout. He's an assistant scoutmaster. He's hilarious. He has a wicked, funny sense of humor. It's just a myth that they don't have a sense of humor. He still struggles some with social relationships and things like that, but we're just so proud of him and love him to death. I mean, just couldn't be prouder, and he's so gentle and calm, never angry, never irritable, now that the health issues have been addressed.
Do you feel, can autism be prevented?
I don't think the entity of autism itself can be, and I'm not even sure it should be, because It's just a different way of being wired. But definitely there are things you can do to prevent and reduce the associated health issues, which are what are so challenging and affect the level of function anyway. For example, if a mother that's expecting takes probiotics during her pregnancy, those children have less allergy, eczema, and asthma. It's something like that that's hard to deal with for years in a young child. That's just less misery. It doesn't change autism necessarily. And if you can be aware of the gastrointestinal issues and you start your new baby on an infant probiotic, you'll likely have a child that sleeps through the night. I wish I had known that all those years ago when I was exhausted. And so it's not so much that autism can be cured or prevented. And, you know, adults with autism tell us it hurts their feelings when they hear us talk about recovering and defeating and curing and preventing autism. It makes us feel broken or unwanted. And so we're trying to change our language to celebrate their neurodiversity and yet acknowledge their health challenges or their language and social skill deficits that need to be addressed. Just like if you had a child with diabetes, you'd be doing interventions for whatever that child needed.
Okay. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you, you know, there are a number of controversial theories, the vaccine theory, the diet, and I wanted to ask you about the role of diet. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I am having a conversation with Dr. Janet Linfala. She's in West Virginia, and she's sharing her experiences and her expertise with 411 Teen listening audience about the autism spectrum disorder. We're going to take a break, but we'll return shortly. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me via phone from West Virginia is Dr. Janet Linfala. Janet, right before we took a break, I was asking you to address diet and what role diet may play in the behavioral aspects of the child with autism spectrum disorder.
That is a great question because diet is very important, and it's also one of the most misunderstood areas about the autism spectrum. So first, let me say gluten and casein do not cause autism. It's free casein, free diet.
I'm so glad to hear you say that.
But there are so many people on the spectrum that have gastrointestinal issues, and that's what the diet is used for. And so anytime you see those headlines in the media that say the gluten-free, casein-free diet doesn't work for autism, they've only used children without gastrointestinal issues. They're trying to see if it affected autism, which was a good question, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's just a tool that we use to support gastrointestinal health because they typically have very poor gastrointestinal health. It's more permeable than it should be. And digestive breakdown products from gluten and casein that are different, you know, they've been digested a little bit, can leak through into the bloodstream, and research has identified these opioid-like neuropeptides that get in the bloodstream, cross up into the brain. It's just like morphine, and that's why they're constipated all the time. And it affects their language areas, and of course, if you're on drugs, it affects your behavior, and it affects your eating patterns. That's why they eat mac and cheese and chicken nuggets and pizza. They're, you know, addicted to these opioids. And so the diet is used to address those issues, and it dramatically affected our son's behavior. Didn't cure autism, but dramatically took out all that irritability and violence. And so now there's an even easier option that I discuss in the book, and we use digestive enzymes to break down those opioids. And you have to be very careful. You can throw them into an opiate withdrawal. Last summer, a Harvard-based doctor identified the first documented case report of gluten psychosis that was not related to wheat allergy or celiac disease. So gluten is, It's an entity that we dance around very carefully on the spectrum, mm-hmm. but I wish the media would understand. None of us think it cures autism.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. Dr. Lymphala is the author of The Unprescription for Autism, a natural approach for a calmer, happier, and more focused child. And Janet, I wanted to ask you to share the impetus for you writing this book.
I have written the book I wish someone had handed to me mm-hmm. when I realized what was going on with my son. There wasn't a roadmap. The internet wasn't very good. There weren't many books written. We didn't have social media at that point, so it was very hard to network. And I wanted to reach out and give a tool to mostly families, but to health caregivers too, to just understand why they behave that, like they do. It's not part of autism a lot of times. It's easy to support and cool all that stuff down. They can run and play and learn like anyone else's child, and that's what we want at the end of the day, is for our child to have a good day.
Okay. What type of accommodations did you utilize in the school setting for your son?
We didn't get any accommodations because he was so verbal. I mean, okay. He didn't qualify for anything. Now, we did have some very understanding teachers. One let him use a computer to type his homework into because he had low muscle tone and poor handwriting skills when he was younger. It's gotten mm-hmm. better. They understood that he had impulse control issues. I have to say, teachers were really good to my son. But he wasn't, caught any breaks or anything. He needed to behave and to do his work. And sometimes we worked 10 times longer than mm-hmm. other kids did.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just so verbal and so smart that he didn't qualify for anything. And I wish that we had understood the sensory issues more and had been able to gotten accommodations where he could stand up and move or sit on a bouncy ball instead of a regular seat. That really helps them focus and concentrate more, to be able to move and to understand that sometimes with those sensory issues, it's like being in a room with 10 or 20 different radio stations playing,
exactly.
trying to listen to the teacher, through all that.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear you focus on the sensory issues, because I think that that is one area where there's really a deficit when it comes to, diagnosis and treatment, that we are not recognizing the role that these sensory issues play in every other aspect of the kid.
And I think about 9 out of 10 of them have sensory integration mm-hmm. problems to some degree, not necessarily a disorder, but it can make life a little challenging for them to deal with. And if people understood that, it's not just when they're children, it's when they're adults too. So I feel it needs to be taken into consideration in the college setting or in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. As a parent of a child who had autism spectrum disorder, what were some of the most challenging aspects?
I think just having to have an iron will because of the discipline problems, the impulsivity and the anger and the lack of sleep and the hyperactivity. I was exhausted because I was also having more babies and I had 2 other children, and if he went into a meltdown, I would have to just wrap around and hold him till he exhausted himself. Meanwhile, I had 2 other toddlers running through the house doing who knows what.
Gosh.
And I couldn't let him go, for safety reasons. And it just...
How'd you do it? Because I know we have parents listening who are like, what is she doing? How did she handle it? I'm in that same situation. What did you find helped?
Well, I encourage people to either turn to prayer or meditation, whatever mm-hmm. their beliefs are. I happen to have the most wonderful husband in the world who was with me all the way. Sometimes I didn't do so well, Dr. Liz. I have one son with Tourette syndrome, who was making all kinds of noises while my son on the spectrum was sensitive to noises, and there'd be a huge fist fight while they were trying to play together. And I remember one time looking up at the sky and shaking my fist and going, what were you thinking? It just didn't seem fair, but we got through it. The three brothers are the best of friends these days. Our house is calm. We learn to one by one just take things one at a time and sort each health problem and address it and give each child, you know, the supports that they needed. And it began, we had to spin a lot of plates. You have to keep your plates spinning. You can't just do something once and forget it. You know, like, you know, if you're taking care of gut issues, you can't just take care of it for a month and then go, okay, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an ongoing, keeping the plate spinning kind of thing. I guess you just have to have an iron will. And I think every parent will step up to the plate and do that. But I have friends come up and go, I couldn't do what you do. And I'm like, yeah, you could.
Yeah, you could. You just
have,
right. Do you find that the symptoms change with age? What role does maturity play?
Maturity has helped a lot. It's helped the boys deal with their emotions and their issues. But, yes, the symptoms change.
Okay.
Any obsessive tendencies or OCD seems to blossom right in the preteen years. The Tourette disorder peaks at about age 8 to 10 and then slowly tapers off through the teen years, hopefully, if it follows a typical course.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety. We went through periods, Dr. Liz, where all of a sudden they're screaming and in panics about bees or things that weren't a problem yesterday. At about age 10, my oldest son overnight became unbearably sensitive to light and sound. And it made it very difficult in the house. It wasn't a problem before that. And we don't know what changed. We don't know if some neuron connected or something matured the wrong way. You know, we don't know, but it, we felt like it was a beast that we would, you know, beat back down into the ground, and then it would pop up in a different
in a way.
Form. And we just always had to be on our toes. I guess we banned the word complacency from our home. We just we knew we couldn't be complacent. We had to be vigilant.
Yeah, and that's a key. That's a key to the success that you have experienced. What can one do after the child is born? I mean, can autism be reversed? Can it be improved? Obviously.
The symptoms can and the function can. I don't know that autism itself can, but for example, my oldest son, when he was 7, we were being heavily pressured to institutionalize him. And because people were saying, you just can't deal with that. That's only going to get worse when he becomes a teenager or an adult. And the level of function difference is night and day when you address the health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still, even after health issues are addressed, you're still going to have from very high functioning to very low functioning. Some people have intellectual impairment along with it. And they will always have to have supported living. So there's no guarantee that just supporting and treating the health issues is going to make this child, you know, completely different. But it can change their quality of life and their level of function. I do not think you can actually reverse, prevent, treat, or cure the autism itself.
Okay. How can one, how can parents assess the risk, your risk of autism?
They can ask their pediatrician to screen. There's a free screening tool online. It's called the E2 form, E as in Edward, E2 form. It's at autism.com. And they score that for free. Now, it doesn't offer a diagnosis, but a score that is generated indicates a probability that the child is or is not on the spectrum. And I think that's an easy, accessible, free way to start. And then I would go to the pediatrician or the developmental pediatrician. Or if your child's older, I would get a comprehensive psychological evaluation.
And would you share your contact information with the listening audience, please?
I sure will. My website is www.loveautismhealth.com. We're on Facebook at Autism Health, and our phone number is 304-255-2550.
In these last few minutes, how big of a problem is autism and other spectrum disorders. And I'm thinking about financially, you know, socially. What impact does it have on the family?
Well, financially, we took a big hit because, you know, we didn't know what we were dealing with, and we traveled everywhere to the top doctors. That meant, you know, either airfare or hotels or meals on the road, babysitters, companions traveling. It was, and the doctors themselves were very, very expensive. Even when you use natural supplements, the doctors were putting us on a lot of supplements. You know, when I do it in my office, I pare it down to the basics because I know how overwhelming that is, both time-wise and mentally and financially. Socially, I think we have to do a lot more understanding of these folks and supporting of them for employment and independent living, or it's going to be a huge toll on them personally and on society. But we need to get them driving and to school and to work and living as independently as they can, and that means taking care of health issues and supporting any kind of like social skills or language deficits that they might have.
Do you have any more information on resources that you may refer parents, families to, in addition to your website? Is there anything else that you would refer them to?
Sure. I love the autism.com website. They list a lot of research. I like science and research. There's conferences there. I love the medmaps.org conferences. Any kind of health professional can go there, even psychologists or nurses. You don't have to be a doctor to go there. Mm-hmm. And, gosh, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and look at all the autism books. The autism shelf was nearly empty when we realized, 14, 15 years ago that our son was on the spectrum. And now it is rocking and rolling with lots of books. YouTube has lots of information. There's support groups on the internet. It was so hard in the old days to get a babysitter and go to actual face-to-face mm-hmm. support groups. And now everyone can do it online. There's beautiful blogs. There's just a cornucopia of information.
Just briefly, can you share what your book is about, what your book covers, the areas that it may address?
Yes, my book is like the owner's manual for how to restore and maintain vibrant health on the autism spectrum. I give step-by-step specific protocols. I just decided to share everything that I do here in my office with my own
patients. Okay.
I lead people in the first chapter through sort of a modified version of my new patient intake questionnaire, which helps spot all the underlying health issues, and it's my tool that I use to talk about the science and all the health issues and what you can do about it. And the rest of the book is exploring the natural supplements that are safe and simple and scientific that they can use just to support health. We're not treating autism. And then I have a chapter on adults. And then I created this really fun bonus online chapter that gives you in the book how to get to it. And it's a year of ideas to explore other therapies and other ideas like swim lessons or service dogs. I even covered Minecraft and Legos for autism. So it's really fun. One of my favorite chapters. So I just tried to create a resource and to reassure them I use a lot of humor and to let them know that they're not alone and that this is not a tragedy.
Any comments on the use of formula versus breast milk?
Well, I understand some women cannot breastfeed, but mm-hmm. if they can, I encourage everyone to breastfeed because we're learning that it is so crucial to the immune system and for the health of the baby. And it appears that there is an immune subtype of autism where they have real immune dysfunction. And breastfeeding is essential for those infants. And so, I'm not going to judge a woman who didn't breastfeed.
Oh, yeah.
But if you have a choice and it's no big deal to you, I would absolutely breastfeed.
In this last minute and a half, words of wisdom that you may offer to families and parents who are dealing with a family member who may have the autism spectrum disorder?
My suggestion is that younger is better, and it's not just because earlier intervention produces better results, but I've been doing this long enough that a lot of my young patients have become teenagers and then young adults, and they're adults. They have legal rights. They have a mind of their own. And at that point, you know, if that's just when you're starting and they don't feel like doing it, there's not going to be much help you can do for their health issues. And so earlier is better. Ask a pediatrician for a screening. Go to MedMaps.org and find a pediatrician. Get the services. Jump in with both feet and do it.
Dr. Janet, thank you so much. We really appreciate your invaluable information. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.